You're listening to Road to Resilience. I'm John Earl.
I had this patient who died, and he happened to die in the same room that my dad died in the hospital. And his story was very similar to my story. And so I sat down and I just started to write. And I started to write about my father's memory. And then that triggered me starting to write about this particular patient. And I just started writing about what I remembered about him, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I realized when I got up and I finished, I felt so much lighter.
Today, you're going to hear a conversation with Dr. Cardinal Smith. She's an oncologist and a palliative medicine physician here at Mount Sinai. Now, there are a couple reasons why I wanted to have her on the podcast. The first is that she's got some really smart things to say about how to process loss. It's something she has to do more than most people because many of her patients are critically ill. And as I found out, it's not something she learned in medical school. She had to figure it out on her own. And she came up with a ritual that helps her grieve and stay present for the next patient. That's a resilience hack to me, and I think we can all learn from it. Now, the second reason is that Dr. Smith has to have really tough conversations all the time. I mean, she has to tell people, your cancer has gotten worse. And she has to help them and their families navigate the most difficult period in their life with all the emotions that come with that. And so I really wanted to know how she does it. And I think her answer, again, is something that everybody can learn from. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation and you get something valuable out of it. Here we go.
So Dr. Smith, can you tell me just a little bit more about your work? Take us through kind of your typical responsibilities, the sort of things you do on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis.
Okay. So clinically, I take care of primarily patients with lung cancer. I do that one day a week in our outpatient cancer center. I also attend on our inpatient palliative care service. So I see patients for consults or in our palliative care unit. Research is really focused around improving the quality of care for patients with cancer with a special emphasis on minority populations. So disparities in the use of and access to palliative care and hospice services is where my research primarily focuses. Additionally, I do research on physician-patient communication and teach physicians how to communicate better or more empathetically with their patients. And then from an administrative side, I really oversee the quality program for our cancer center, which is related around improving outcomes for patients with cancer.
Got it. So in terms of the clinical side, like about how many patients do you see a week and what sorts of illnesses do they have?
Yeah. So I see about 20 to 25 patients per week. They primarily have lung cancer. And unfortunately, because lung cancer is typically diagnosed later, I would say about 75% of my patients are diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, which is incurable. And then the other 25% are diagnosed with more earlier stage disease in which the goal of care is cure.
The question I really want to ask you is, like, were you like a really chill like person, like a child? Like when you knew you were going into this specialty, you knew you were going to encounter kind of a lot of really hard stuff.
So I do happen to be very chill at baseline. That is my general temperament. However, I don't think that that is why I chose this field as a specialty. I think what initially drew me to this field was science. Oncology was a field where treatments were changing drastically. And that part of it fascinated me. And as I went through training and got to realize there's this big component of oncology that really is about that patient-physician relationship and this continuity and there's this connection where patients and their loved ones bring you into this really hard time and really trust you, and you become essentially a part of their family. And there's something that's truly appealing about that. Even if I'm not able to cure everyone, I'm able to really get a sense of what they value most and make sure that I can give them that type of care that I know they would want. Hmm.
So switching gears a little bit to self-care, where does your self-care journey begin?
So it's actually an embarrassing story. When I was in hematology, oncology, and palliative medicine fellowship, it was my last year of fellowship, and we started this book club. I'm not really sure why we did that. It's not as if you have tons of time to read for pleasure when you're in training. But the book we chose is this book called Leukemia for Chickens. And so if you've never read it or you want to read it, stop listening because I'm going to give a spoiler. So the only time I had to read this book was when I was going on vacation. And in hindsight, that was probably poor planning on my part. But I was on the plane with my husband and we were flying to Puerto Rico. And I was reading the book. And as I got towards the end of the book, suddenly the person in the story is talking about, you know, he essentially had leukemia. He had a bone marrow transplant. Then he developed graft versus host disease as a consequence of that transplant and was admitted for a second time and was having really horrific symptoms. And when I turned the page, it said epilogue. And I thought I must have missed a page. But in fact, the epilogue began with his wife saying, you know, I am now writing this for him as he asked me to continue the story if he was ever unable to continue it because he died. And I became really emotional and started crying, ugly crying, as they say. And I really couldn't stop. And I remember the flight attendant came over to us to ask if I was okay. And even though my husband kept elbowing me to stop crying, I couldn't. And it was, I realized in that moment that I was remembering all of those patients I had cared for in the previous 3 to 4 years that I had been a fellow that had died and that I had actually never grieved for. And in fact, it was even during my fellowship when my own father died of stage 4 cancer. And I thought about that also. And I realized that I took care of all of these people and got to know them and their loved ones, and they died, and I never grieved for them. I never said goodbye to them in any meaningful way. And I knew that if I was just now at the beginning of my career, that this was something I was going to have to address and really have to think about how I was going to acknowledge that and manage it.
So you had never been taught self-care techniques in medical school, for example?
I certainly was never taught self-care techniques in medical school. Part of our palliative medicine training does certainly touch on self-care. At some of our meetings, we would have, you know, the first couple of minutes where there would be some meditation. But I, you know, as a trainee, when you have to like get to the next patient and get to the next patient, it's really hard to take a pause and to focus internally on yourself. And so I never really took advantage of those opportunities. And by the time I finished my palliative care year, which was just 1 year of 4 years, and I went back to oncology, there certainly are no opportunities at that time to focus on self-care within oncology. And in fact, you know, the book club was an attempt to do that.
Yeah. So you have this moment, you're like, oh man, I need to take care of myself better. Mm-hmm. And what do you do?
First thing I did was I asked my friends, you know, what do you do? I went to some mentors or, you know, advisors whom I trust to ask what they do. And I realized that from my friends or my mentors, advisors within oncology, no one really had a good answer.
Wow. How do you explain that? Is that like a macho thing or?
You know, truthfully, I think part of that is there is this sense of failure when patients die, that, you know, perhaps as the clinician, you didn't do everything you could do. And there is this internal guilt because ultimately we become clinicians, physicians specifically, to help cure people, right? To help them live longer lives. And when we don't do that, we see that as failure. It's also not something that we're taught to make a priority, which is why what ultimately happens is that you end up getting a lot of burnout within healthcare and in the field of oncology specifically, that's very high.
So you talked to your oncology colleagues, they didn't have a good answer for you. You talked to your friends, they started to have some answers. And you said a moment ago that you started experimenting with some of these things. Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you experimented with?
Yeah. I tried meditation in the many forms in which it comes in, including the apps. You know, thinking in my train ride in, I'll do the app and it'll be a couple of minutes and I'll get it done, or even longer, you know, at home before I had children. And it is really, for me personally, it's really hard for me to shut my brain down. And I recognize that I likely did not give it as much energy and effort as I could have. But that just, if I had to put so much work into just shutting down my brain, I figured there was something else that I could do. So then I started trying to exercise, which is not something that I sustained, particularly after I had children, because there are really just only so many hours in the day. Then I turned to reading. Reading is certainly a pleasure of mine, and I still do it. And I read trashy books that I probably won't talk about, but, along the lines of 50 Shades of Grey, because they help me get outside of myself. It's hard to read self-help books and medical dramas because I feel like that's what I do all day. Then I turned to swimming. I really enjoyed swimming, did that with one of my daughters. But none of those things were things that I really felt like were something that were sustainable long term.
And you were still feeling like whatever this thing was inside of you wasn't being processed, or
yeah,
is that accurate?
I would say that's accurate. I would find that when I was at home with my family, I would be preoccupied, or if I was watching a TV show and there was a scene on the show that somehow triggered the memory of a patient, I would remember that patient and then I would start to get tearful. And that's, not quite normal. Or if I was speaking to a loved one or a friend and they said something that, reminded me of a conversation I had with someone or a specific circumstance, particularly with a patient or their family, then I would also get a little sad. And then I would start to get angry. And I had no idea where those feelings were coming from.
So how did you end up finding a way to process it?
Trial and error. When I was in college, I liked writing, but I never wrote for, not to say fun, but for my own pleasure. And one day I had this patient who died, and he happened to die in the same room that my dad died in the hospital. And his story was very similar to my story. And I realized that, that really brought back memories of my own father's death. And so I sat down and I just started to write. I came home one day and I just started to write. And I started to write about my father's memory and the interactions that I had around his death. And then that triggered me starting to write about this particular patient. And I just started writing about what I remembered about him, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I essentially started to write like a goodbye. It was like a goodbye. I finished that with, it was great to have the pleasure of taking care of you. I hope you're in a better place. Till next time. And that was it. And then I realized when I got up and I finished, I felt so much lighter. It felt nice to do it. And I didn't know if that was because it was related to my father or him, but when I had the next patient who died, I sat down and decided just to write about that person similarly. And I realized, again, it felt lighter. It was closure for me. I felt like it was a really great way for me to honor that person's memory and yet also say goodbye. And so I started doing that for probably close to a year, and I kept this journal. And I would just every time write in this journal. And then my daughter, who started to learn how to read, picked it up one day. And she's like, "Mom, what's this? What's this?" And I thought, oh, no. And I went back and I had never previously read the passages that I wrote before. And as I started reading them, it brought back all of the memories of those patients. And I felt sad again at that loss. And so I don't know where it came from, but I just had the idea that I would start shredding these entries after I wrote them. So what has now become my practice through trial and error is once I have a patient who dies, and it doesn't have to be that same day, but certainly within that week, once the house is quiet, I go to my desk. I light an electric candle and I write about that person, usually with a glass of wine, but maybe sometimes with water. And then when I'm done, I blow out the candle or turn it off and shred that piece of paper. And that shredding that piece of paper feels really final and like closure to me. And it very much internally feels like I've now closed the door on one chapter and am ready to move forward to the next.
So do you have a piece of writing that you can share with us today?
Yes, I do. I first met you about 1.5 years ago. What I remember most about that encounter was how I was struck by your intelligence, both street smarts and book smarts, and also how your anxiety and fear of the world was utterly paralyzing. The world had not been fair to you, and I often wondered what life could have been like for you had you had different experiences and did not have an incurable lung cancer at such a young age. Unfortunately, your cancer did not respond well to any treatment we gave you. Your anxiety was certainly a challenge, and I can remember more than one occasion when I felt apprehension when I got your email or my chart message. Caring for you was hard, with multiple exclamation points. It took twice as long and was incredibly draining. It's hard not to feel like somehow I let you down instead of the inadequacy of our current treatment options. Still, I think my team and I did the best we could, given the resources of the healthcare system and your own abilities. You enjoyed 2 trips during your treatment, and I'm overjoyed that you had the opportunity to enjoy them. In the end, I believe you had a peaceful death. I was able to say goodbye to you, which is sadly something I'm not always able to do with my other patients. I know faith was important to you, and I hope that provided you with solace and that you are now free. May your memory be a blessing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's so much that I love about that. It's like, it's personal, but it's also very kind of like real and level-headed. And it's, I guess this ties into something that I am wondering about. It's like, how do you protect yourself without desensitizing yourself?
Oh, that is a great question. I don't know that I do that 100% all of the time. I think that I have come to a place where I'm more insightful. And so when I realize that I'm being more curt or I feel like I'm being much more dismissive or short, then I realize, I've probably hit a wall and I'm reaching, you know, some form of burnout. And then that's when I will take a step back. And so actually that happened to me recently. And I told my husband, well, I just need a little break. And so we randomly booked a trip for a couple of days to go somewhere with the girls. I don't know that there is a way to protect 100% of that. It's hard in this environment. The best I can do for myself in this moment is trying to be aware of when that happens. And also my team and I challenge each other to recognize that in one another. And I think that's critically important because none of what I do is alone. And I have, you know, an interdisciplinary team of nurses, social work, chaplains who also hold me accountable. And that's really helpful.
What do you hope that other physicians can learn from your experience and what you've learned?
Yeah. Well, I hope, you know, other physicians will realize that self-care is not a bunch of hand-holding kumbaya stories. And in fact, that this whole topic of resilience and self-care, that there is an evidence and science basis for it, into why it is so incredibly important. And also that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, don't get thrown off if people tell you you have to go do Reiki or meditation or so. You know, you just have to find what works for yourself, but you have to work on it.
Is there a spiritual component?
Oh, that is a hard question for me as, you know, I grew up very Roman Catholic. Church every day.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Church every day until I was 21 and I decided I didn't have to do that anymore. I stopped church every day probably when I went to college, but very much entrenched in that religion. So, yes, spirituality. I don't know what form that is, though. I think that's still something that I'm figuring out for myself.
What are your tips for kind of, I guess I would say, delivering really hard news?
So the motto that I live by is that communication skills can be learned and therefore they can be taught. So when delivering bad news, there's actually a communication skills scaffolding for that. It has several different acronyms, but the basic premise is, one, to make sure you have all the right people in the room who needs to hear the information. Two is that you get a sense of what that patient or loved one knows about the underlying illness. And that's because if you start to tell them what you know and they're not there, then you've just unleashed Pandora's box. Next is to really invite the conversation and ask if it's okay to share what you know. Because if they say anything other than yes, you're not going to be in a place where they're going to be able to hear the news. And then next is really to give that news, but to give that news in a way that there is a warning shot, you know, whether that is, unfortunately, I wish I had better news, to give it succinctly without a lot of medical jargon. So, you know, I could say the CAT scan shows that, you know, the cancer in the liver has grown by several centimeters and also in the lung, or I can simply say the cancer has gotten worse in the liver and in the lungs. And then the next part is to recognize that people are going to have emotion when they hear the bad news, right? So it is to respond to that emotion by not hearing questions as cognitive questions. So, you know, what does this all mean? Either I could take that as a cognitive to say, well, this means that your cancer has gotten worse and now we have to talk about the next steps in treatment. Or you can take that as the emotional question it probably is and then respond with, I can only imagine how scary it must be to hear this news. And then finally, summarizing and strategizing about next steps. So, you know, I know we talked about a lot today. You know, if someone asks you sort of what's going on, what are you going to tell them? And, you know, then making sure that information is correct and saying, that's right, and here's what we're going to do now.
Right. What's something that happens in your work that you can't explain?
Oh, that's a really interesting and hard question. I can think of two things that are kind of related. I would say one is there is this phenomenon that I see with patients whom are at the end of life where, I don't know if you want to call it a rally, but they have this moment of intense clarity. Either, you know, the day or several days before their death where, you know, they just all of a sudden get more energy, they're more interactive, they're having great conversations with their whomever, family and loved ones, and everyone's like, oh, they're getting better, they're improving, and then they die quickly thereafter. And that's something that I cannot explain why that happens, but it is something that I see frequently.
What was the other thing?
Oh, the other thing is, so patients with advanced cancer who are no longer getting cancer-directed therapy, so no chemo, radiation, you know, nothing for the cancer itself, who choose to get supportive care only, so palliative care only, whether that's with hospice or not, often live longer than I anticipate them to do. And I'm thinking of one patient actually who was just disenrolled from hospice after being on it for 9 months with stage 4 lung cancer that's not being treated. I think there are certainly are some reasons for that. And we know that focusing on someone's symptoms and quality of life can lead to prolonged survival, but often not in those terms. And so who knows what's happening with the actual biology of that cancer that's contributing to that.
What does death sound like?
What does death sound like? I think that depends on the circumstance. I think death can have no sound at all, or death can sound, you know, like my toddler when she's having a tantrum. Or it can sound like screaming and wailing and lots of sadness.
What's something you've learned about death and dying from your patients?
I've learned that death is promised to everyone, that it will happen to everyone eventually, and that it is an intricately personal experience, and that even though patients may not choose a death that I would choose for myself or for my loved ones, ultimately it is aligned with how they have lived their life, and that really my part in that journey and their ability to entrust me in helping them through it is to make sure that I have heard them and listened to them, and provide them with the kind of care that they have asked for when it's the end of their life.
And what have they taught you about how to live a good life?
Oh, they have taught me to not neglect the little things in life, and that each moment is precious. And it can be so hard in the day-to-day to realize, that this thing is not really a big thing in the grand scheme of things, and that sometimes you just have to learn to let things go. And I won't say that I am perfect at that, but I think that I am definitely better than others.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Smith.
Thank you.
It's been such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Cardinal Smith is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Hematology, Oncology, and the Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She's also the Director of Quality for Cancer for the Mount Sinai Health System. Thanks so much, Dr. Smith, for sharing your story with us. Road to Resilience is a production of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It's produced by
Katie Ullman,
Nikki Hudson,
and me, John Earle. Our executive producers are Dori Klesis and Lucia Lee. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. If you like the show, please subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And if you really like the show, say hi. Our email address is podcasts@mountsinai.org. That's it for this episode. I'm John Earle. We'll see you next month with more stories from the Road to Resilience.